The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And it's the Indie Week, a weekly magazine read by John Federson today. And this issue is dated November the 3rd of 2023. And my folder is fairly thick with some articles, which have mostly come from IndieWeek.com. And that's where I'm getting most of them, as I've mentioned before. So let's get to article number one. First, Durham Crisis Response Center, facing a series of steep budget cuts, is asking the city and county for help. In a meeting on October 10, Executive Director Damian Talley asked county commissioners and members of the city council for $250,000 to shore up funding for the center's 24-hour emergency domestic violence shelter. The shelter houses victims and families escaping or recovering from abuse. He said, "We need this much money to continue doing what is necessary." Talley also requested that the Durham Crisis Response Center be added as a line item in the city and county budgets. Over the past 2 years, the city has seen at least $1.5 million in budget cuts, Talley reported. Meanwhile, the demand for services is high. In the last year, the center sheltered over 100 women and their families and answered nearly 2,000 crisis calls, he said. He said at the meeting, "DCRC has had to make some incredibly harrowing choices to ensure that we are able to continue the life-saving work of our agency. However, the likely impact of those choices cannot be clear. As the sole domestic violence shelter in Durham, it's constantly at full capacity, often having to refer victims to nearby shelters." The budget cuts come on the heels of opening a new office space and renovating the shelter this past spring. Federal funding for sexual assault and domestic violence services have dropped as a result of reduced Victims of Crimes Act funds and the end of COVID-era programs. The state received over $100 million in Victims of Crime Act funding in 2018. In 2023, just over $40 million from the same source. Kathleen Lockwood, policy director of the NC Coalition Against Domestic Violence, said that in the coming year, the amount is expected to decrease once again. Domestic violence service agencies across North Carolina are feeling that drop in federal funding. Orange County Rape Crisis Center, which works in partnership with Durham Crisis Response Center, announced in August that it was cutting staff by 50% and caseloads by 60%. These cuts come at a time when domestic violence homicides are rising in the state. As of October 4, 59 domestic homicides have taken place in North Carolina, up from 47 in 2022. The need for violence services surged across the state and nationwide since the start of the pandemic. Lockwood said, "Unfortunately, that trend does not seem to have diminished." From 2021 to 2022, the number of unmet daily requests for services more than doubled in North Carolina. Talley says, "As we see services being cut, we can guarantee more homicides are going to take place. Lives are going to be lost." On top of those funding losses, Durham Crisis Response Center recently lost a competitive grant administered by the NC Governor's Crime Commission. This grant funded an immigrant services program, LGBTQ service, and veterans outreach. 10 staff members have been laid off due to these cuts, including the LGBTQ coordinator, said Talley. The center also had to disable its 24-hour Spanish hotline, which received over 500 calls last year. The center is taking steps to try and compensate for these losses, he said. For example, it has hired more bilingual staff to serve Spanish-speaking callers, while the hotline is out of commission. He said, while our staff is willing to do it, we're just adding more tasks to the ever-depleting employees. Lockwood said the North Carolina legislature has made efforts to fill funding holes for domestic violence service providers, but the amount still falls short. The Crisis Response Center's request will need to be further discussed with the city manager, the full city council, and Board of County Commissioners before any next steps are taken. Meanwhile, several who attended the October 4th meeting voiced their concern for the organization. Brenda Howerton, chair of the Board of Commissioners, says it's a conversation we need to have to take care of the people that really, truly need our help. Next, an article by Cy Neff. Durham, an open table ministry, will rent 10 rooms at local hotels. In recent years, Durham's rents and homeless population have risen in tandem. As temperatures drop, people living out of their cars and on the streets are at risk of freezing to death. Durham faces a chilling statistic. 50 of the city's families have self-reported as unsheltered homeless. Rebecca Bourgeois, the street outreach program manager for the nonprofit Housing for New Hope, says, it's scary when we have this number of people living on the street, families. Close to more than half of those have children under age 5. As a mom, I can't imagine not having somewhere to go and not having an emergency plan in the coldest part of the year. Today, November 1st, the city of Durham, in partnership with Open Table Ministry, will begin renting 10 rooms at a local motel for unhoused community members. 6 rooms will be set aside for unhoused families, with the remaining 4 reserved for highly vulnerable individuals and couples. Provided the program remains on budget, the rooms will be available week to week until the end of March of next year. Colin Davis, the homeless system manager for Durham's Community Development Department, says the first group can go to the shelter today. The first group to go into the shelter today will stay week to week, regardless of the temperatures, saying, we're doing this with the goal of getting them into permanent housing. All the shelters in Durham with the ability to serve families, that's Urban Ministries, Families Moving Forward, and the Durham Crisis Response Center, are consistently at capacity. On white flag nights this coming winter, when temperatures drop below 32 degrees, Families Moving Forward and Urban Ministries will make overflow space available for families in need. And I parenthetically say that there's a nighttime temperature of 29 degrees coming up, I believe, tomorrow, which is a Friday. The gap between the emergency motel's available family rooms, 6, and the number of families reporting as unsheltered, 50, is striking. Bourgeois says, as a city and as a system, I don't think that any of this is adequate. Durham's Continuum of Care, the city's multi-organizational effort to combat homelessness, faces an array of issues in devising a winter weather plan for unhoused residents. According to Davis, Open Table Ministry was the only organization willing to operate an emergency shelter. The early pandemic federal funds that helped bankroll an emergency congregate winter shelter in 21 and 22 have dried up. The current lower capacity motel shelter is funded entirely with city money. Davis says it's hard to guarantee that you can find a hotel that will have X number of rooms available with very short notice, and the cost is prohibitive. This is our way of stretching what we have. Right now, we're tapped out by what motels are comfortable doing and what we can sustain funding-wise. According to Drew Wotan, executive director at Open Table Ministry, there are trade-offs between running an emergency congregate shelter and a motel shelter. While congregate can often serve more individuals, they present logistical challenges. Wotan cites the difficulty of safely housing individuals and families side by side in a congregate setting, the lack of spaces in Durham willing to host a congregate shelter, and difficulties hiring and paying reliable overnight staff as reasons for choosing to operate a motel shelter. Wotan is clear, however, that motel shelters run into their own sets of operational difficulties, among them Durham's turbulent real estate market, saying, "We had an original motel, and we called 2 weeks ago to confirm a November 1st start date, and the management had sold the motel and decided they did not want our contract." Wotan acknowledges that the motel shelter will not meet the needs of all community members, but with the goal of providing case management and rapid rehousing services, as well as meals, and a motel with kitchenettes in room, the 10 rooms are what his group can offer. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the need, he says, but it comes down to how many rooms we can find, housing services we can provide, and the amount of quality rooms that we can afford. He adds that last year, Open Table offered motel rooms that were cheaper, but not up to the standard the ministry wanted for its guests, saying it's about balancing our budget and our bandwidth. Davis says the city is talking with local faith leaders regarding the possibility of creating spaces for families on emergency cold weather nights, although it's unclear that will come to fruition this winter. Currently, the city has no plans to build new shelters and increase its overall bed capacity. Davis points to limited funding and resources and a need for strategic allocation, saying, "Do you put limited resources in temporary solutions, or do you put resources into permanent solutions to turn the beds over more frequently? You could build more emergency shelter beds, but if people can't exit those beds, you just have a bigger log jam. If you can figure out exit strategies from an emergency shelter and turn them over every 30 days as opposed to 90, that's more people you just helped without adding an extra bed." Homelessness is often described as a symptom of broader societal illnesses and not necessarily a cause. Davis, Wotan, Bourgeois, and others working in Durham's homeless system can overhaul their programs and work with the funds they have, but much of what pushes families out of homes and onto the streets is outside their control. North Carolina cities can't legally implement rent control, and tenants' rights in the state rank among the worst in the country. Durham's housing crisis has no end in sight, and developers announcing behemoth projects across town from Haiti to Northgate have made few commitments to contribute to the city's affordable housing stock. Bourgeois hopes more organizations will step up and help combat homelessness. She says, "This year in particular, we're seeing more and more families on the street. The system just was not built to handle that. Expanding shelter for families is a 5-year process, and we have people experiencing crisis right now. I'd love to see more churches and other groups open their doors and provide some kind of safety net for people, especially on nights when it's going below freezing." A parenthesis to this article says, if you or a loved one is facing homelessness in Durham, please call Entry Point Durham to set up an intake by phone. Entry Point Durham is at 984-287-8313. That phone number again for Entry Point Durham, 984-287-8313. So this next article is actually about an event that has already taken place at the end of October by Sarah Edwards, but I think it's very intriguing and a worthwhile reading. So I'll take up some time reading Building Community and Sharing Skills in a Really, Really Free Way. where can you get a primer in ASL, brake pad changing, and how to make laundry soap, and maybe pick up some free shirts and shoes while you're at it, all in one go? In Durham, that answer lies in North Durham Mutual Aid's Really, Really Free Market, RRFM. That's an annual event where neighbors come together to exchange clothes, skills, and ideas. Shortly after the pandemic, in the spring of 2020, a surge of mutual aid groups sparked up around the country as an already thin social safety net became more threadbare. Initial tasks like getting groceries for people who couldn't leave home in those scary first few weeks or checking in on neighbors intensified as the country reared toward an eviction crisis and efforts to mobilize vaccination became more urgent. Years later, that initial wave of communal neighborhood efforts has rolled back. But some groups have hung on and formalized into more serious long-term efforts locally, like Katrina Parker's work with Feed Durham and the community fridges you may see around the triangle. And several years later, North Durham Mutual Aid, that's a group by its website that coordinates efforts across the neighborhoods of Northgate Park, Colonial Village, Bragtown, and surrounding areas, has also kept up momentum and neighborhood relationships. There's also a long-standing RRFM event in Carborough. This year, the group celebrated its fourth annual Really, Really Free Market on Saturday, October 28th, on East Main Street from 1 to 4. Ahead of the event, the Indy emailed Q&As with Carolyn Stayer Brewington, a coordinator for the organization, to learn more about Really, Really Free Markets. Tell me, what can people expect? They can expect a great time, she responds. It's hard to leave an RRFM without feeling inspired and connected. Anyone who comes will have the opportunity to share and receive items like clothing, house supplies, art, etc., to share and learn new skills and to make friends. Everything at the market is entirely free, with no profits or trades. At this market, we'll have folks teaching guitar, car maintenance, massage, embodiment and grounding skills, growing food, sign language, crocheting, and more. What's the history of RRFM? The first known RRFM of this kind is credited to an event at a Food Not Bombs meal in Christchurch, New Zealand. The markets gained popularity in the U.S. in the early 2000s. This is our fourth market at NDMA, and we hope to make the free markets a seasonal institution in Durham. What's the most surprising item that's been donated or exchanged? Oh, man. Maybe less than surprising is just the overwhelmingly heartwarming stuff people give to each other. One time, someone set up a griddle and made happy face pancakes for everyone. Another person set up a station to write and receive anonymous love letters. I've seen someone give away their deceased father's extensive funky tie collection. It's really beautiful what people offer to one another when given the chance to share instead of donate. The North Durham Mutual Aid Group hosts. Can you tell me a bit about that concept? Mutual aid basically means helping each other out. It's a response to the shortcomings of government and nonprofit programs to meet people's needs. Our anchoring phrases in our group are, we already have everything we need, and we take care of each other. We highly recommend Dean Spade's book, Mutual Aid, for anyone wanting to learn more about the practice. What kind of local things is your group involved in? Our specific mutual aid group was born in March 2020 as a response to the skyrocketing social and economic inequalities that were quickly exacerbated by the onset of the pandemic. At that time, we organized to pool resources for our neighbors' unmet basic needs, like safely obtaining food and having money to cover bills and medicines. We've continued our essential work without a lapse since then and are still providing consistent monthly financial support and biweekly grocery deliveries to neighbors in need. This work is currently sustainable for us, but the need is far greater. And if anyone's interested in helping expand our capacity in these areas, we welcome you to join us. We also have broadened the scope of our work beyond pure crisis response to provide the city with seasonally really, really free markets, and have fostered offshoot projects that are now self-sustaining, like reading groups and a community garden in Colonial Village. I imagine it's been hard to sustain momentum since early pandemic days. How has that been for y'all? Sustaining momentum has definitely been hard at times. I think what really keeps us going is our collective emphasis on making sure we're having a good time. In the face of such dire suffering, it can feel like radical work to insist on joy and laughter while we do all the other necessary things, like ensuring consent and balance for tasks we take on and caring for each other emotionally. I keep showing up to NDMA meetings and events because they're always fun. How can folks get involved? We would love to help everyone in Durham to get plugged into mutual aid work. You can reach out to us on Instagram at North Durham Mutual Aid, or via email at northgateresponse@gmail.com, or sign up in person at the Really, Really Free Market, which has already occurred. You can join the work we're already doing, or present ideas for new projects. We want everyone to enjoy mutual aid in a way that's sustainable and life-giving them for them. There's plenty that needs doing. So once again, if to get involved in this from the article, Instagram has at North Durham Mutual Aid, one word, or via email at northgateresponse@gmail.com. Okay, over to Orange County and Carrboro, as the Carrboro Town Council has approved a Creekside Greenway alignment for Bolin Forest. This dated October 23rd. There were signs on Tuesday night that the Bolin Creek Greenway was back on the agenda in Carrboro. Every spot in the town hall parking lot was full, and not because of the weekly dance class at the town commons. By the time the council meeting kicked off at 7 p.m., both the meeting room and a separate overflow room were filled to capacity, with half a dozen spectators standing in the hallway. More than 40 residents had signed up for public comment, many with sheets of prepared remarks in hand. Back in March, Carrboro Town Council publicly reopened the long-running Bolin Creek Greenway debate by directing town staff to conduct a six-month public engagement process regarding potential greenway alignments. In July, Indy published a deep dive on the history of the greenway debate. Earlier this month, Carrboro concluded its public engagement process with two-thirds of responding residents favoring a Creekside Greenway alignment. Catherine Lazorco, Carrboro's Communication and Engagement Director, said at Tuesday's meeting, of the 1,700 survey takers, a majority, about 66%, selected a Creekside alignment. She noted that existing obstacles for ability to use trails in Carrboro are lack of connections, followed by unsafe street crossings and accessibility concerns. Public engagement included a survey available in six languages and town staff's presence to provide information and answer questions at 16 community events. In light of the Creekside alignment's broad support, town staff drafted a motion asking the town council to move forward with development of a Creekside Greenway alignment. Over 80% of community members that spoke during the public comment period advocated for the Creekside alignment. Many residents claimed affiliation with the Carrboro chapter of Democratic Socialists for America, which conducted a door-to-door campaign advocating for the Creekside alignment, or the Carrboro Linear Parks Project, which was instrumental in the Greenway debate's resurrection. Allison West, one of the leaders of the Carborough Linear Parks Project, said thank you to everyone who has spoken up about the need for an accessible greenway network in Carborough. Everyone in town should be able to access this space as a place to move a little, a place to move a lot, or a place just to be. West opened her comments by thanking Lazorco and town staff for their work on the public engagement process, a sentiment that other supporters of the Creekside Alignment echoed. Supporters also noted the importance of children having alternative routes to local schools, as well as the greenway serving as part of a broader transportation network that eases the areas dependent on cars. Triangle blog board member Melody Kramer said, I want my kids to be able to walk and bike to school for health, for their brains, and for them to be able to experience nature on a daily basis. And I don't just want this for my kids. I want this for kids across Carborough. Not all residents, however, were impressed with the town's survey or saw the Creekside Alignment as an environmentally or fiscally wise choice. Carborough resident Brian Monahan said, the Creekside Alignment is not only the least ecologically friendly of the options, it's also the most expensive and the longest for people who want to get to school in an efficient manner. The town did an amazing job of outreach, but unfortunately it was focused on this survey that was incredibly biased. I think some of this public support is misleading, partially because of the way these options were framed. Town Council member Susan Romaine, whose perspective on Bolin Creek has changed over the course of the debate's lengthy lifespan, offered her reasoning for supporting the alignment. She said, over the past 4 years, my position on the best alignment has slowly evolved. My education has been through many of you in this room. I've learned that the Creekside Alignment does have various serious environmental risks. I've learned that it can be hugely expensive. I now believe also that the Creekside has the potential to deliver the most powerful benefits and offer community members of every age and physical ability and socioeconomic background safe and affordable spaces to commute, recreate, reflect, socialize, and really enjoy the awesome beauty of Bolin Forest. Friends of Bolin Creek member Diane Robertson said the decision to pursue a paved Creekside Greenway is a selfish one that will carry dire consequences. She said the insistence on destroying the riparian buffer is a conquest in a colonizer point of view. The abuse of resources to support a small group that can be only defined as privileged is not surprising, but certainly disappointing. The vote taken tonight will be done by a lame duck council that will not be responsible for the fallout of this project. The council voted to approve the resolution sent over by town staff, with Councilmember Randy Haven O'Donnell as the lone dissenting vote. An addendum that further planning of the alignment should factor in the town of Chapel Hill's plan for a greenway extension to Estes Drive was added on to the resolution. Town Council member and mayoral candidate Barbara Fouché expressed wariness of the town's division over the greenway and stressed the importance of moving forward as a united community. She said, I know that this decision is going to create angst and more divisiveness, which is something I don't want. I'm asking the community stays at the table and be engaged no matter what happens. There's more layers and processes to go, and community engagement will be key, and let's try to move forward together. We're better together. We really are. Next, another column from Durham by Justin Laidlaw, written November 1st, and it's about the Fayetteville Street Improvement Project. This is a long article. I may cut some of it, or and because in consideration with other articles that are also available, drive down any major road in Durham. There's a chance you're riding on a highway in disguise. Irwin Road, Roxborough Street, Alston, Fayetteville, Duke, Chapel Hill, University, Durham Chapel Hill Boulevard, Holloway, Gere, Cornwallis, Hillendale, Hillsborough, a huge chunk of Durham's roadways are owned and maintained by the North Carolina Department of Transportation, DOT. They're responsible for more than 81,000 miles of roads statewide. Only Texas Transportation Department maintains more miles of road than North Carolina's. Any changes to those roads are subject to DOT review before the city can consider adoption. In September, this tension came to a head. Members of Durham's Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Commission, BPAC, a citizen-led group that advises the Council and Board of County Commissioners, sent a letter to city and state officials rebuking a recent DOT decision to halt an infrastructure improvement project on Fayetteville Street near the interchange at North Carolina 147. The Fayetteville Street bike lane project would bring new traffic patterns and bike lanes to a half-mile portion of Fayetteville Street between East Main and East Umstead. It's part of a group of street redesigns planned throughout the city, totaling 8 miles. The largest project at Stadium Drive and Olympic Avenue will span 2.5 miles. BPAC demands the original and already approved plan for the Fayetteville Street bike lane project be reinstated, that work resume on this project immediately, and that this last-minute reversal be reprimanded at DOT, said the letter. But John Sandor, the DOT district engineer for Durham, Granville, and Person County, says despite the fact that the city had done an analysis and provided a design for the project as well as bid out the project and awarded a contract, DOT never actually gave the city the final approval that was needed to move forward. Sandor says we were very clear up front that the city's design was going to be a challenge. Following that letter in September, Sean Egan, the director of City of Durham's Transportation Department, clarified the miscommunication in an email back to BPAC, saying that the issue stemmed from a misunderstanding of DOT's request for more analysis and pressure from the community on the Durham Transportation Department to keep projects on a tighter schedule. The city had already done an analysis of the project and submitted a design to DOT. After not hearing back from DOT, Egan says the city assumed it had the green light to proceed with the project. We've really been focused on moving our project forward. Egan adds, since there were no outstanding questions or comments from DOT's district or congestion manager on the city design, the city moved forward the bidding and awarded the project to NPS Solutions for about $500,000. Work on the project was slated to begin this fall. Egan continues, we're not really in a position to wait on every single one of our projects for questions and comments from DOT. If we did that, we wouldn't be able to move our projects and get them on the street. So in a case like this, DOT can always come back and say, we've done the additional review, we have checked with congestion management, and they've raised objections to doing this. And that's exactly what happened. Sandor said, we never had a version of an analysis that showed that it could work with separated bike lanes without some real traffic issues cropping up. There's just too many cars right there. Planning for the 8 miles of project started in 2018. City of Durham received funding from Federal Highway Administration for these projects through Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Improvement Program grant. Sandor says DOT serves a managerial role on many projects like these, collecting and distributing funds to the different municipalities. Quote, the FHWA has assigned that role to DOT to be that proxy to make sure the project gets built properly and those reimbursement dollars come back to the city through DOT. We essentially bankroll a lot of these off our budget. Then the CMAQ grants come in and fill in behind it. So DOT is always covering the costs of all these various projects, and then we go and seek reimbursement back from the federal government. But the management of those funds was compromised in 2020 when the state auditor's office put DOT on probation for overspending its budget by 12.5%. The department was forced to lay off temporary staff and furlough employees, as well as press pause on hundreds of projects that weren't already under construction. In addition, budget constraints and delays due to COVID stalled progress on the CMAQ projects planned for Durham. Implementation is finally set to begin this fall on the remaining 7.5 miles of new infrastructure, but now excluding the Fayetteville Street portion. The BPAC letter argues that DOT did not approve the Fayetteville Street bike lane project, quote, due to traffic congestion concerns projected for 20 years from now. The letter criticizes DOT's decision not to approve the design on four major points: the cost of a last-minute cancellation to the city, congestion concerns from DOT being, quote, not well-founded, lack of commitment to Transportation Safety Initiative Vision Zero, and more disinvestment in the historic Haiti neighborhood. BPAC member Mary Fontana lives near the area where Fayetteville project was anticipated. She says folks who bike or walk are forced to look for alternative ways to commute through the neighborhood. I'm going to skip a little portion of this, but Sandor says that DOT's approach is rooted in data. We want to see it in analysis, he says. One of the things we point to is when someone says, well, if we get rid of this car lane and put a bike lane in, we'll eliminate those people's need to take a car because they'll now be riding a bike. Nowhere in this country has that happened. There's no research that supports that theory. So the bike people say DOT will have to use a different approach if they want to meet their goals. The governor has signed an executive order to achieve zero carbon emissions, and vehicle miles traveled is one of the strategies for getting there. In order to do that, the analyses that are being done is can't just assume that VMT, vehicle miles traveled, is going to go up. If you're always going to accommodate it, you're not going to achieve those goals. As Mr. Talmadge said, one of the many advocates who spoke during the budget hearings in support of city staff hiring a Vision Zero coordinator. That's a nationwide initiative to eliminate transportation-related deaths and serious injuries. DOT has indicated it would relinquish ownership of the roads to the city of Durham for no upfront costs, says Egan. DOT maintains roughly 800 lane miles in Durham, but the yearly maintenance would require more annual revenue from the city's coffers, which would necessitate raising taxes. According to estimates from Public Works, the cost of maintenance activities over the life cycle would range from $7,000 per lane mile to $140,000 per lane mile for repaving. That's on top of an already existing $180 million backlog of maintenance requests for current city-owned roads. Funding has not kept up with the level of need from the Public Works Department, says Egan. If we're struggling to keep up with the streets we already own and maintain, is it the right way to take on additional maintenance responsibility for state-owned roadways? Anyway, we'll skip now to the future of transit in Durham. Since the controversial light rail program failed to leave the station a few years ago, the city's been researching ways to bolster other types of services by introducing concepts such as the bus rapid transit, which would give buses priority on strategic roadways throughout the city, reducing travel times. Future plans could also include a substation in East Durham, where bus ridership is higher than any other stop besides downtown. All the differences, approaches to transit are on the table moving forward. Durham will have to rely on collaboration with the Department of Transportation and strong process for community engagement to ensure all the various stakeholders are represented in the city's future transportation network. But it's not as easy as adding bike lanes wherever residents may want them. Sandor says it's going to be a whole mix of different things. I look at the American Tobacco Trail as such a great project, and Durham's got the Beltline Trail coming. Those are going to be your transformative projects that offer very significant improvements to moving the needle and providing people legitimate options to that very problem as we urbanize and get more crowded and congestion. The City of Durham and DOT are also in the process of reimagining a section of 147 freeway that runs through the heart of downtown. The federal government has made grant funding available to states and local municipalities through Reconnecting Communities and Neighborhoods program, an initiative that will improve connectivity by removing, retrofitting, or mitigating highways or other facilities that create barriers to community connectivity, including mobility, access, or economic development, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation website. And as we know, folks in Durham have long cited the construction of NC 147 as the largest contributor to the dissolution of the city's historic Heytai district back when the freeway was first built. Egan says the U.S. Department of Transportation is looking at the legacy of federally funded highways that were built by bulldozing historically black and brown residential and commercial districts and the harm those projects did to disadvantaged communities. We have a tragic history in Durham of roadway projects that have impacted particularly African American residential and commercial communities. We don't want to repeat the mistakes of the past. And that concludes my slightly edited version of this long, lengthy article about the bike paths lanes in Durham. Now, this Lena Geller has written on November 1st a long article about Wake County prosecutors who, she says, seem intent on pinning a series of air gun shootings on a resident of Holly Springs. The article is too long for me to go into in detail, but it's called Trials and Errors. And you can find it, if you're interested, as all of these articles, at indieweek.com. And that's free access to that. And you can read the article, including links to other stories and photographs that I can't describe to you. And it's an eight or nine-page article. The defendant is named Henderson Atwater. This has gone through a couple of trials with accusations that he discharged an air gun shooting and had injured or made some injured people and property with these shootings. But there is insufficient evidence, except circumstantial, that links him to these. And yet, the article concludes that prosecutors and police they seem intent at pinning this series on this man. So that's all I will tell you right now. Then I can get on to some further shorter articles to fill up our time. So next we will get to a food-related article by Gabrielle Lazar, written on October 19th, foraging for gourmet food that's lying around for free alongside Durham's fungi devotees. John Hawkins drives the edge of his fingernail into the underside of a mushroom, slicing across its buttery gills. Beads of royal blue ink, the defining feature of this indigo milky species, ooze up from the cut. He then paints his forehead with the fresh fungi blood. Now marked with the mushroom smear from his latest conquest, Hawkins plunges deeper into the forest with warrior-like stealth. He soon discovers an Amanita species known as Caesar's mushroom. It was a favorite of the early Roman empires. That fiery orange shroom can be consumed raw. Thank goodness, because Hawkins didn't eat breakfast that morning. He nibbles away at the tender cap before finding another double-fisting fungi. After attending a seminar on how to safely hunt for mushrooms, Hawkins, who describes his occupation as an agriscaper, that is, someone who creates landscaping designs solely with edible plants, and a handful of other foragers were lucky enough to test their knowledge in the woods at Down Yonder Farm in Hillsboro. The group, three women and four men, millennials to baby boomers, represent but a fraction of local fungi fanatics, and no, these are not the psychedelic kinds. The mushroom excursion and seminar is led by 63-year-old Frank Hyman, a college dropout. It's really just a vocational school for rich kids, he says. Former Durham City Council member and author of How to Forage for Mushrooms Without Dying. That's his lesson for the day. Hyman says for the foraging community, it's kind of a ridiculously fun activity that involves finding gourmet food that's lying around for free. Being outside is the best part. He wakes up hungry for breakfast and vitamin D, and then finds his food on the forest floor. On a recent Saturday, before the invite-only foraging expedition, more than 30 mushroom fanatics gather in the farm's meeting room. A picture of Hyman is projected on a screen at the front of the room. He's beaming next to 33 pounds of lion's mane, a monstrous mushroom species with a shaggy appearance. The crowd arrives brimming with questions, scribbling answers in their notebooks. Phones aren't allowed in Hyman's classes. Are dogs affected by poisonous mushrooms the same as humans? Yes, dogs are mammals. If you harvest a lion's mane with some brown inside, can you just cut off the brown and eat the rest? Yes, just like an apple. Can you talk about canning and marinating? No, Hyman won't. He's not a canner, and there's not enough time to discuss marinating. Check Google. Even though he considers the internet to be a relative net loss to society. Hyman says the key to successful mushroom hunting is judgment, not intelligence. The consequences for mushroom misjudgment can be serious, particularly if the wrong species are consumed. The effects can include liquefied livers and kidneys. As Hyman clicks through a slide presentation showing different mushrooms, hands shoot up to identify each species. It's clear the attendees know their way around a shroom or two. More slides present pictures of food porn. That's mushrooms sautéed in butter. After the workshop, the farm's owner, Jesse Gladick, brings out a buffet of puffballs. Hyman foraged for... Excuse me, I have to change pages here. For guests to bring home. She unloads the bulbous lumps from Whole Foods grocery bags, dirt raining down under the table. Puffballs have a tofu-like texture. The largest ones are big as cantaloupes. Amateur mushroom hunter Stacy Murphy lives on 35 acres of land in Virgilina, Virginia, where she spots mushrooms all the time on her walks. When she's not foraging, Murphy can be found renovating historic properties and managing rental properties. The day before the workshop, she was shocked to find an impressive 4-pound specimen, saying, I turned the corner and I looked up and I'm like, oh my God, it's chicken of the woods. With a texture said to resemble poultry, chicken of the woods grows in shelves on deciduous trees. It's a gateway drug, Murphy says of the species, just because it gets people hooked on wanting to find more. She uses the flesh in her halal chicken recipe. Hyman says nothing tops the euphoric feeling of finding your dinner in a tree. Foraging is like the best Easter hunt you've ever been on. Easter egg hunt. Throw the fungi in a hot pan with oil, add some seasoning, cook for 10 to 15 minutes, just like that. Dinner is served. After the presentation, Murphy joins Hawkins and the rest of the group hunting. In addition to finding clusters of Caesar's mushrooms and those indigo milkies, The foragers encounter an unsuspecting pure white specimen that Hyman believes to be an Amanita mushroom known as a death angel, which can cause liver failure and death. After we published this particular story in Indy, we heard from another expert that it was a different type of bright white Amanita. Hyman then confirmed it was not a death angel and was in fact another type, though he said it also could be dangerous. He lifts up the appropriately named mushroom. If you have frenemies, you know what to do. Thankfully, Hyman and the owner of Down Yonder Farm have had sufficient practice in IDing mushrooms. There's still functioning organs testify to that. But for Hawkins, his forehead marked with the indigo milky, it is his first time foraging. He's pleased to go home with a nice haul. That night, he prepares breakfast for dinner. He begins by cooking bacon on the stove, leaving the excess grease in the pan. To the pan, he adds chopped chunks of the freshly foraged indigo milky mushrooms, letting them sear in the bacon fat. Adds parsley, garlic, and a little bit of salt. They simmer over low heat for about 25 minutes, the blue blood mixing with the fatty oils until the mushrooms crisp to a dark greenish blue. Then, Hawkins feasts on an indigo milky mushroom omelet, the yellow eggs stained slightly by residual blue ink. He says, it was like yielding but semi-rubbery, almost like cheese, like a squeaky cheese. Now, he forages nearly every day. Those things were really good. And what the heck? Why not read another food-related article, at least, by Lena Geller, written back in the end of October, how gas stations in the American South mirror their communities. Kate Medley likes to eat lunch at gas stations. She developed the habit in the early 2000s, soon after she started her career as an itinerant photojournalist covering politics and social justice in the American South. Her work often takes her to small communities where lunch options are often limited. Between fast food and whatever the local gas station has on offer, she says the latter is the way to go. Her first foray into professionalizing her lunch routine was back in 2012 when she photographed and co-authored an Indie Week story about gas station food in the Triangle. After the story was published, Medley, a Durham resident who grew up in Jackson, Mississippi, continued the project, eventually landing a book deal with the Bitter Southerner. Her decades-long journey culminates next month with the release of Thank You, Please Come Again, a hardcover collection of photos capturing 75 gas stations, filling stations, as Medley calls them, across 11 southern states. While food is a focus in Thank You, Please Come Again, mouth-watering depictions of a sushi restaurant tucked inside Handy Hugo's had us hightailing to Apex, the book isn't exactly a guide to eating along the interstate. Some of those stations in Medley's images have closed. BMW Pit Stop, for instance, a gas station that Medley photographed in Moon Lake, Mississippi, shut down several years ago. But the photos of BMW Pit Stop, one of which shows a handwritten note taped to the door reading, "If you need something and we are closed, please call Kevin. I'll come right over and get it," will still tell you a whole lot about the culture in Moon Lake. Through Medley's loving eye, we get a look at how gas stations can function as mirrors of their surrounding communities and see what's lost when they shutter. So this is a Q&A. How did you decide which stations to photograph? A lot of the time, there was just something in my gut that caused me to pull off the road. In retrospect, I primarily visited independently run gas stations. Some of them were affiliated with corporate oil companies, but they were usually locally owned. There was sort of a framework of, if the head of marketing isn't behind the cash register, then I'm going to move on. I always look for a sign of the human hand. That's a terrible way of putting it, but like I was looking for a sign of a person's touch. At one of the first places I stopped, there was a cascading row of hand-painted signs out in the highway. There's something about the imperfections of a hand-painted sign. It's like a language to me. You start looking for the person behind it. I did notice a lot of handwriting in your photos. It's one of the greatest art forms. It points directly back to a person, how the person was feeling that day, where the person comes from, where the vision for their business is. So handwriting was always a big initial draw for me. Then you get inside and you see little pieces of saran wrapped cake at the cash register. You see a bulletin board with signs for a lost dog or some wacky class. You see all those reflections of the community. A lot of the places you stopped at had taxidermy on the walls. Is that common or were you seeking it out? I don't know if I've seen taxidermy in a gas station before. There's a lot of taxidermy in the Florida Panhandle, but it's in other places too. One of the taxidermy images in the book is from Heritage Grill in Durham. It's definitely a subculture within southern gas stations. Hunters will stop by in the morning to fill up a thermos of coffee or get a sausage biscuit. Then they'll go kill deer. Then in Hurdle Mills, for instance, they'll bring the deer back for processing at the gas station. So these places will put trophy pictures on the wall or hang the deer heads up. You also took a lot of photos of workers. Some are posing, but most are shown in their natural state. It's refreshing to see pictures of service workers who aren't forced to smile. This is a book about the working class South. It's about a book who keep the South in motion, literally and figuratively. These are run by workers, and their customers are largely workers. Tell me about how gas stations have evolved over time. It used to be very common for gas stations to have full-service mechanics. That was their economic driver. Today, we see much less of that. You see a lot of these places, especially in more economically depressed areas, ripping out the gas tanks and just going with convenience store and food offerings. So that's one aspect of things. We're also seeing a lot of emerging foodways happening in the backs of these places. The majority of gas stations in the United States are run by immigrants. I'd love to see a master's thesis charting the population shifts in the United States by way of gas station food. So I'm afraid I will have to pause that article about gas station food and telling you that you can revisit the entire article with some photographs on IndyWeek.com. And I hope you'll be with me, John Federson, next week when we get to our next issue of the Indy Week. And this broadcast, which is to go out on Friday, right after its initial broadcast, was always available in the podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. John Federson saying so long.